Good afternoon, everyone. I am calling this meeting of the Committee on Taxes to order for March 5th, 2024. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from February 29th, 2024. Vice Chair Norris, do I have a motion?
Yes, Chair Gomez, I move adoption of the minutes from the February 29th meeting.
Vice Chair Norris has moved adoption of the minutes from February 29th. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, please say no. Motion carries. The minutes for February 29th, 2024 are adopted. So today we are very, we're lucky to have a visitor in Tax Committee for the first time. We're joined by Nico Luciani, who's the Director of Corporate Governance at the Roosevelt Institute. He's going to talk to us about some issues, some trends in corporate profits and tax base erosion, and kind of touch on corporate monopoly power. And so part of the impetus for us having this conversation today is that, you know, in the February forecast, one of the big drivers of the difference between the November and February forecast was this increase in collections of the corporate franchise tax. And as we saw in the slides from MMB, of course, corporate collections track really closely with corporate profits. And this was also the case, you know, in our huge surplus that we had last year is that you know, a lot of that that surplus did derive also from the increase in corporate profits, especially among those largest corporations in the country that we saw during the pandemic. And so we're really pleased to have you here. I look forward to a good discussion about this material. We'll be hearing a couple of related bills tomorrow and also hearing from our state economist, Dr. Columba Kitas, who will be joining us to kind of zoom in from what Mr. Luciani is going to present to us today, which is sort of more of a national picture. So looking forward to the next couple of days. And I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Luciani. Thank you so much for being here. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Sure. Thanks very much. My name is Nico Luciani. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm the Director of Corporate Power at the Roosevelt Institute. We are an economic think tank. Before coming to the Roosevelt Institute, I worked on corporate tax transparency for several years, collaborating with academics, public officials, private sector companies, really forward-looking companies that were on the move around public country-by-country reporting and other tax transparency requirements. Worked with standards bodies and accounting firms, institutional investors, and public advocates around the world. So it's really been great to see from a distance the significant strides you've been making here in Minnesota around getting more information about corporate tax transparency. So in my presentation today, I wanted to make four key points. The first is corporate profits at the very top of the U.S. business hierarchy have skyrocketed in the U.S., especially since 2021, while smaller firms, even medium-sized firms, are still in the red. These profits of the largest firms are not being used to support workers, to drive innovation, to boost real productive investment, or support the public good as much as they could be. Instead, a lot of these profits are being siphoned off to the wealthiest shareholders. The second point I want to make is that the concentration of corporate earnings amongst the top 10% of corporations is driven in large part by the ability of these firms to capture market shares through monopolistic or unfair competition practices. Market concentration in the U.S. has risen sharply over the past decades, and with this market power has come political power to shape the rules of the game, including the rules of the tax game. The largest multinational corporations have strategically and persistently used this power to decrease their tax costs, which I'll show. The federal corporate income tax, where I'm going to spend a lot of time later on in the presentation, is really a shadow of what it once was. The lowering of rates, the weakening of tax authorities, the use of pass-through entities have all contributed to this, but a large, large factor is the ability of companies to use offshore profit shifting to lower their tax costs overall. While the corporate tax was once a key tool to resource public goods and to level the economic playing field. Today, it's being used to benefit the largest firms across the economy at the detriment of the smaller firms. And then the fourth point I wanted to make before we jump into the stats is that corporate taxation is, as I said, a critical rule, tool to raise revenue, to level the playing field, but also to build public trust and citizen morale. I've worked on tax policy in various different countries in the world, and it seems like a soft role of building citizen morale and building public trust. But when people believe that the rules of the tax game are rigged, they're less likely to want to engage themselves, to pay themselves, which creates a vicious cycle of lowering tax revenue and ultimately less public goods. And so that's essentially the four points I wanted to start off with. And so what I've done today is put together a presentation which is based on the facts, evidence we've collected over several years. And I'm looking forward to a great conversation at the end of it. But first, I wanted to start some of the problems we're grappling with in the economy today. Raising prices, for example. Related to that, this phenomenon of shrinkflation, where companies are reducing the quality of goods or the amount of goods with the same price. The dearth of productive investments, although that's changed a little bit recently, over the past 30 years, we haven't seen the type of real productive investments in the economy that we need to grow the economy and to make it sustainable into the future. Brittle supply chains, we saw during the pandemic, the impact of relying on just-in-time supply chains that don't have the inbuilt resilience that's needed when there's a shock like the pandemic was. Wage stagnation, declining state and federal revenues, although they go up and down in any given session, over the long term, we'll see it's really been a steep drop. Inequality of different kinds and a decline of new business entrants, the inability of new businesses to really thrive. They seem like very disconnected problems, perhaps. What I want to show in this presentation is that there are some important interconnections between all these problems I think we'll all recognize. So this first graph I wanted to show, I know it's hard to read. And sorry,
everybody has a copy of the presentation in their packet if they want to follow along. That might be easier than these little TV screens. Sure. Yeah. Definitely.
So this is sort of a graphical outline of what I want to talk with you today about. The blue line at the top is corporate profits as a percentage of GDP, going all the way back to the post-war period, 1947. Doesn't go all the way to 45, but almost. We have data that far back. And as you see, since 1947, corporate profits dropped a little bit, were stable for a very long time until around the early 21st century, 99, 2000, where it really skyrocketed, up to about, in the year 2020, about 12% of our GDP is attributable to corporate profits, the biggest on record. So the question is why, and why does it matter that there are so many more corporate profits than there used to be in the economy? That's going to be the first sort of section of the talk. The second section is going to get to that green line, which is corporate income tax as a percentage of GDPs. As you see, since the post-war period, federal corporate income taxes have consistently dropped from about 6% of GDP in the early 50s to under 2% of GDP now, more like around 1.5% now. And the second section of this presentation is really going to get into the hows and whys and what fors of this steep decrease in the corporate income tax. But just as a general picture, we have the corporate income tax is a profit tax, right? You would think that as profits increase, so too would corporate income taxes. But as you see, since the early 21st century, that has not happened at all. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the questions of why. So first, let's talk about concentration of profits. The overall picture here, this is from Fred, the Federal Reserve, is the first blue line that I mentioned before. We see a huge uptick in corporate profits, after-tax profits as a share of GDP since 2000. This is overall. And so it makes it seem like the business sector as a whole is doing really well. The corporations are doing really well since 2000. But what I want to show actually is that there's a subset of corporations, and we could break it out however we wanted to, but for ease, the top 10% most profitable companies are the ones that are enjoying these huge increases in profits. So the next slide, this gets to the question of the difference in profit margins between the top 10% of firms and the bottom 90% of firms. When we talk about the top 10% of firms, what does this mean? This is the top 350 more or less publicly traded C corporations in the country. The bottom 90% are mid-cap, small-cap companies all across the economy. And you start to see that, you know, in the 1970s, they were at par in terms of profit margins. That orange line is the differential between the profit margins of the top 10% and the bottom 90%. Over time, there was increased change between what the top 10% were earning in profit margins and what the bottom 90% were receiving. So we see over the past 20, 30 years, especially the past 10 years, that difference of the green bar between the blue bar, the green bar being the top 10% of firms' post-tax profit margins and the bottom 90% has drastically changed. This is important because, you know, profits are more than just sort of an indicator of economic success or financial success of a company. They're also it's a broader macroeconomic indicator to understand relative power between firms and between firms and workers. And we'll come back to this a little bit. But what this really tells us is that the top 10% of firms are starting to walk away with the lion's share of the economic returns in the economy, where the bottom 90% are not. The next slide gets to this question of the overall profit share of the top 10% of firms. Back in 1971, the top 10% of firms controlled about 70% of the overall profit share. In the last 3 years, that's changed to 95%. So just think 95% of the overall profit shares of publicly traded companies is controlled by the top 10% of firms. Most of, I think 50% of publicly traded companies are actually not profitable. And instead, all of that profit is being captured at the very top. Now, you may say, well, who cares? That's what businesses do. They profit maximize. Indeed, they do. And if those profits were used to support workers, to support real public investments through capital expenditure, to engage in R&D and innovation, those and to pay, you know, a significant share of their tax burden, that would be one thing. But as we see in the next slide, most of those profits, indeed amongst the top 10%, around 90% of net income, after-tax profits, is going to share repurchases and dividends, not to capital expenditure, not to R&D, not to strengthening workers' wages and benefits. So the next slide is just capital expenditure, and again, apologies, we can't see it very well, but you have it in front of you. It's figure five. This contrasts the top 10% of firms' capital expenditure ratios to the bottom 90% of firms' capital expenditure ratio. Capital expenditure ratio, this is all from the company's financial accounts directly. It's just the money they spend in capital expenditure for productive investment over their revenue. And again, you see the same pattern that in the 1970s, all of these firms, whether the top 10% or the bottom 90%, had around the same capital expenditure to revenue ratios. But over time, since the past 20 years or so, that has changed, where actually the bottom 90% spend more as a proportion of their revenue on capital expenditure than the top 10% of firms that are the most profitable firms in the economy in the world. And that tells you that the profits matter because they're not being used to productive ends. Instead, they're being used for shareholder payouts. And that's the next slide. What do I mean by shareholder payouts? That is simply looking at the company's financials and looking at dividends plus share buybacks as a percentage of revenue. And there you see that's increased over time. And again, the top 10% are paying out a higher percentage of their revenue in shareholder payouts than the bottom 90% of firms. A big portion of that difference is dividends, but an even bigger portion recently is share repurchases or stock buybacks. You might be familiar with these. This is the practice of large companies who consider that they have excess cash, don't know what to do with it, and instead they want to use that capital to buy back their own shares. You're probably familiar that with the fact that before 1982, that was considered market manipulation. It was considered a way of juicing up your stock prices, because when you buy on the open market your own shares, you're reducing the outstanding shares available, and therefore your earnings per share goes up just mathematically. There are fewer shares in the market, your price goes up. And so that's very good if you own shares, if you're a senior executive that gets paid in performance pay based on the share price. It's good if you own a lot of shares, but it's not great if you don't, because the profits are not being reinvested as they used to be in the company and in the workers and the productive tools of the economy, but instead is being passed on to shareholders. And you may think that's not a big deal, that actually, in 2021, $1 trillion of share buybacks were purchased by top corporations. What does that really mean in terms of juicing the stock price? It's a relatively small number as a percentage of their market capitalization. This is an interesting chart that a group called Pavilion Global Markets put together, which is a stock brokerage. And they estimated that in 2022, 40% of the increase in stock price was attributable to stock buybacks. Not the kind of company fundamentals of price equity multiples or earnings per share, but just the buybacks. That's the green that you see. Was about 40% driver of the increase in stock price. So it's a pretty significant thing that the companies are doing, essentially extracting value out of their out of the economy and passing it on to shareholders. Now, many of us may have 401ks or retirement accounts that are invested in some of these companies, and it may look good temporarily that the stock price is going up like this, but I just wonder if this is sustainable, if this is something that's really based on fundamentals of the economy or instead extractive. And if you zoom out and look at who actually owns corporate earnings in an absolute sense, this is the next pie chart. The top 0.1% most wealthy own 20% of corporate equities in the United States. And all the benefits that are associated with them, such as dividend cash payments and all the benefits from equity appreciation that come from buybacks. The top 1%, which is the blue and the orange, control over 40% of corporate equities in the United States. And then just the top 10% control somewhere around 82% of all corporate stock. So that's just to say that, corporate profits and the payouts that come from them is not an equal opportunity phenomenon. It's really benefiting the top 10% most wealthy. If you're in that group, it may benefit you for a short period of time. But if you're everyone else, it's really not showing up in your economic life. And in fact, the bottom 50% of Americans own only 1% of stock in the United States. So that gets us into a little bit the question of how are companies able to capture so much of these profits and not invest in the things that really matter in the economy. And part of that gets back to this question of monopoly power and concentrated markets. I'm sure here in Minnesota you're very familiar with this problem. It's a problem across the economy. This is just an example of consumer staples. You may think that a lot of different products that are in your grocery aisle gives you a tremendous amount of choice between different corporations. But in fact, over time, over the past 50 years, more and more companies have bought out all of their competitors. And this is just an example in the consumer staples market where all of these different brands that we enjoy on a day-to-day basis are only controlled by eight or nine companies, and that's continually decreasing. And the fewer companies that are there, the more opportunities companies have to set the prices, to set quality, and also to set the labor market for people that are working for them. Similarly, beyond consumer staples, you all are, I'm sure, very familiar with airline consolidation, which has happened over the past 20 years. We have increasingly fewer and fewer and fewer airline companies, which not only has the effect of increasing prices and reducing quality of airline flight, as you probably experienced directly, it also has been shown to decrease routes to rural areas and really reduce consumer choice. And this is just some examples across different markets across the United States of how concentrated they've become. And I won't go through the list at all, but this is just to give you a sense of things. This is from the Open Markets Institute in 2018. It's gotten worse since then. But let's say cell phone providers. 98% of the market is captured by four companies, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint. If you look at dialysis centers, you know, 90% of that market share is controlled by two companies. Many of the issues that your constituents are facing on a day-to-day basis, I think, relate back to the fact that the goods and services that they need, deserve, and are trying to purchase are reducing in quality and increasing price, largely because there are fewer and fewer market actors out there, fewer and fewer companies to be able to provide choice. And then this next slide is just to show that this was not always the case. We didn't always have a bigger is better corporate sector. We used to have much more diversity up and down the economic ladder of companies, and we used to have a lot fewer mergers and acquisitions than we do today. You see, basically from 1900 all the way through up till 1960, with some tiny little mergers and acquisitions during right before the Great Depression, there was essentially very few mergers and acquisitions in the U.S. economy. But starting in the 1990s, for a number of different reasons, including the tax code, but also changes in how the antitrust enforcers did their job or didn't, merger mania has taken over the economy and is a big driver of that market power that I talked about before. And here we see that the biggest, what you call superstar firms, the firms that have the most market share in our economy, not the small businesses, not the mid-cap businesses, but the biggest economies, companies across the economy, not only do they have the biggest profit margin, but they also have the biggest market share. This is just to say that superstar firms, the top 10% of corporations, it is their ability to capture markets which allows them to increase their profit margins. It's that power to dictate prices and quality that allows them the power to increase their profits by increasing revenue and decreasing costs. And speaking of costs, they're the same firms that increasingly rely less on labor. So companies that have less of a market share across the U.S. economy, they hire more workers. But those that have higher market share actually hire many fewer workers. And if you add this all together across the U.S. economy, we looked at all publicly traded companies that we can get access to their financial accounts all the way back to you know, the 1930s, 1950s, excuse me. And we looked at a relatively simple number, but I think indicative number, of sales. Their sales over their cost of goods sold. And there's lots of different economic indicators, but this one is probably the best way to put a pin in or kind of indicate where the U.S. economy is. Markups, essentially. Sales over cost of goods sold. Since 1957, Corporate markups of all corporations has really skyrocketed, especially in the period around 2020 and 2021. In 2021, corporate markups increased to the highest level on record. You see that very sharp jump there. When companies were increasingly essentially able to increase their sales and decrease their costs simultaneously for a number of different reasons, which we can get into. Part of the reason they could do so was they could take advantage of the inflationary environment to change the expectations of themselves and their investors to kind of hold on to that pricing power and increase their sales during a time of instability. And it wasn't all companies that were doing this, that were marking up their prices and lowering their costs to such a huge degree. This is just breaking down businesses by percentile. And it's really, if you look at the top 10% and then the top 15%, where the blue line and the red line, that's where most of those hikes happened, where the markups really shot up. And again, I'd underline the blue line of the top 10% of firms that were able to really take advantage of the pandemic to increase their markups and their profits quite a bit. Whereas the bottom 50% of firms, their ability to mark up was really reduced. And that gives you a sense that some companies have more power, more pricing power than others. And if you were listening at any time during the big spike in inflation in 2021, listening to Bloomberg at all, Bloomberg TV, all investors and analysts were talking about which companies have pricing power and which companies don't have pricing power, because they wanted to invest in the companies that have pricing power. And these were the same top 10% of firms that we've been talking about this whole presentation. Okay, how does this relate to the tax committee, you might be asking? The first thing to say is that tax costs are generally somewhere between 10 and 25% of any company's financials. That's a significant amount. As profit-seeking entities, there's no question companies are going to look to reduce their tax costs in any way possible to increase their profits, to be able to pay out shareholders in a way that sets in within their own particular incentives. The role of, public officials like yourselves is to create a set of rules which don't allow for this type of extractive excess behavior, in my opinion. So going back to federal corporate income tax, in any given year you might be seeing ups and downs and backs and forths, but this I think is really illustrative of a broader trend since the post-World War II period. So this is for federal corporate income tax revenue as a percentage of total revenues. It's not a percentage of GDP, but basically the amount of federal corporate tax take compared to the rest of the total federal revenue take. And believe it or not, post-World War II, corporations were contributing about 40% of overall federal tax revenue. That was for a number of different reasons, given the World War II tax system, but also because companies at that time wanted to contribute to the war effort and the rebuilding effort afterwards. And there weren't as many opportunities at that time as you could imagine to shift your profits into offshore tax havens. But over time, that's decreased steadily. And if you just think about from the post-war period up until about 1979, some people call the Greatest Generation, some people call the Great Moderation, the time when the economy was flourishing the most. The amount of corporate income tax that was raised as a percentage of overall federal revenue was about 20%. Yeah. Since 1980, that's dropped to about 10% on average. So today, it's around 8 or 9% in 2022-23. So about 10% of our overall federal tax revenue is raised from contributions of some of the most profitable corporations the country and the world's ever seen. And that's a historical kind of contrast. The next one's just purely, looking at our trading partners, looking at our economic competitors across the world. This is all OECD countries. And the orange is simply, you may not be able to see it there, those are the G7 countries, so closest economic competitors and analogs, we could say. We have, as a percentage of total revenue, we have the least corporate tax revenue of all G7 countries by far. And amongst all OECD countries, we're the third to last. That the United States is right next to Greece and Hungary in terms of the amount of corporate tax revenue we are able to capture as a percentage of our total revenue. And so, you know, why is this happening? Why has the corporate income tax revenue decreased over all of these years? And why are we outliers in relation to the rest of the world? As I mentioned before, the decrease of rates plays a role, for sure. The increasing use of pass-through entities plays a role, for sure. The under, in my opinion, criminal underfunding of tax authorities at the federal level in particular plays a huge role, as the tax auditors there have a hard time with previous resources to really audit a large, complex corporate and partnership income. But another big factor, which you all know about and have been working doggedly on, is the ability of companies to offshore their profits and shift their profits artificially into low or no tax jurisdictions. So this next slide is just looking at the increasing use of five specific tax havens. Netherlands and Luxembourg, Singapore, the Caribbean as a whole, Switzerland and Ireland. You know, pre-1980, 1982, tax havens weren't used that much. As you probably know, the federal tax system didn't allow the type of loopholes and breakages between different jurisdictions to allow for the type of profit shifting we've seen recently. But starting, you know, especially in the 1980s into the 1990s, this practice has really exploded. And just, you know, the numbers here show that, you know, around, you know, 2020, which is the latest data we have, around 13% of all profits of U.S. corporations are booked in these five tax havens. And not all of these tax havens have that type of substantive economic activity in them to justify it. And so, you know, we've talked a little bit about the tax code and how corporations have lowered their tax costs over the past, you know, half century or so. There's another thing that's happening when we don't properly tax corporate income, especially at the very top, is that we create unfair advantages for the top most profitable and multinational firms at the expense of so many other companies. I'll give you just a few examples. So in the tax code over the, you know, it's been there for about 100 years, there's a provision around tax-free reorganizations, which essentially allows a merger and acquisition, a form of merger and acquisition called reorganization, to happen tax-free. The capital gains are basically deferred indefinitely. I think 50% of the mergers and acquisitions over $1 billion over the past few years has happened through that vehicle. And that's essentially subsidizing, you know, more and more mergers and larger corporations. Another example which I would point to is when you have a flat corporate income tax rate, as we have now, as enacted under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in late 2017, it really puts you know, unequal economic players on an unlevel playing field. Given all the inbuilt privileges we've talked about that multinational and large corporations have, when you have a flat income tax rate, it really puts, you know, smaller firms at a disadvantage in comparison to the larger firms. And then there's all the different ways, as I'm sure you know, that larger corporations, they have more profits, so they have more motivation to lower their tax rates. They're going to do what they can to structure their affairs in a way that are almost impenetrable to tax auditors, both at the state level and the federal level. And that creates really unequal treatment between those very, if you want to call them sophisticated, very complicated taxpayers' filings and all the rest of the small businesses that are just trying to get by. And there are various other ways that the federal tax code is really undermining a fair economy with fair competition. And we tried to look at what that means empirically. And so that's just this this slide here, which is looking at the top 10% of firms, again, their profit share. Okay, and we look at them pre-tax and post-tax to see the effect of the tax the U.S. Federal tax code on their overall profit share. And you've heard this story before. In the 1970s, there was more or less some parity between companies, the top 10% of firms' profit share pre- and post-tax. In fact, in 1971 to 1974, these firms' profit share decreased once they paid taxes. But ever since then, and especially over the past 8 or 9 years, that's flipped. And now, pre-tax, the largest corporations have post-tax, the largest corporations increase their profit share for no other reason than the tax code is subsidizing their ability to concentrate whatever markets they're involved in. I have just a few more points I'd like to make. The last one is just, why do we care? I mean, how did these failures to tax corporate profits affect the economy? And the way I kind of think about tax policy in general, but corporate tax policy in particular, is through this framework of the four R's. The first thing that, you know, corporate tax does for us is it raises revenue, and that's front of mind for tax policymakers like yourselves. You know, working families lose out when they don't have the type of public goods and services that revenue could pay for. But there's three other R's that I'd like to mention. First, the second R is redistribution. As I'm sure you're aware, the corporate tax is really about taxing capital owners, many of whom, including foreign shareholders, wouldn't get taxed otherwise. And so it's a redistributive tax that is able to tax undertaxed or untaxed individuals and institutions. And is therefore a really important redistributive tool in our economy. And it may be, you know, seem somewhat, you know, novel to say that the corporate tax code has a role of kind of restructuring our economy. But going back to the progressive era through the New Deal, people understood the corporate tax to have a very concrete role in leveling the playing field across the economy and actually giving a leg up to small business and medium businesses against the biggest businesses of those times. And that's important because, you know, a less monopolistic business sector, it's not only good for the economy as a whole with more competition, more economic rivalry between many different firms, but it also provides a lot more economic opportunities for workers, but also for entrepreneurs. I've talked with many entrepreneurs that are starting businesses, and they complain to me very often about the inability to compete on tax level playing field with a lot of their bigger competitors. And then finally, as I said before, the corporate tax is really important in setting a tone of, of people being represented in their government. People that see that tax rules is rigged to benefit the C-suite or multinationals, it really discourages people, and I'm sure you've seen that with constituents. But on the contrary, you know, people that see a tax system that's supporting working families and small businesses while holding the top corporations and individuals to account, that can really help to energize people to engage again in their citizen duties. So I wanted to just close with a couple of things of what can be done. Some of this may relate to the state of Minnesota, but it's really just more generally than, federally. We have an ability to, and I'll start with these four principles. The first one is ability to pay principle, which is a fundamental part of our tax system. The second one is rule of law. The third one is creating a floor beyond which corporations can avoid tax. And the fourth one is around, fourth principles around transparency. So first on ability to pay, as you know, in the personal income tax side, at the federal level, we have an ability to pay principle with increasing a graduated rate system, which increases as you go higher up in the economic ladder. And that makes sense because those with more revenue pay a little bit more as a percentage over a certain amount back into the system. We used to have this in the federal corporate income tax code, wherein the very profitable companies would pay over a certain a level of profits a slightly higher percentage than small businesses did at the time. And given the extraordinary market power that the top 10% of firms have, and the reality that most economists would agree that there's regular profits, which are the product of fair competition, and then there are excess profits, which are based on rents, which are based on market power, which as rents, by taxing them, you wouldn't be decreasing investment. You could actually be increasing economic efficiency. So that's a little bit about a federal corporate income tax rate going back to a graduated rate. I think one that really applies to the federal government as well as state governments is really looking at wasteful and unnecessary economic development incentives. Many studies have been done to show across states, and I don't know the specifics of Minnesota, forgive me, but in many different states at the federal level, it's often the largest, most profitable corporations that gain the lion's share of those economic development incentives. And a consistent periodic review of the economic and tax benefits of those type of incentives are really, really important. And then the second principle around proper enforcement and the rule of law, you can have the best designed corporate tax rate and tax system you want, but if you don't have robust funding of tax authorities and tax auditors to hold companies accountable to the rule of law, the companies are going to look for gray areas. It's just what they do. And so it's super important at the federal level and potentially, you know, at the state level to make sure that those authorities and those auditors have you know, the means they need and expertise they need in-house to be able to really understand and take apart corporate tax filings. The third principle is on a basic kind of a corporate tax floor. I think I've heard here in Minnesota you do that through a minimum fee or an alternative minimum tax of some kind. The idea there, of course, is to say, hey, it doesn't matter all of your tax planning. Under a certain amount, you're going to pay no matter what, right? We can't let you get down to zero corporate tax payments. But that is actually a very live debate happening within the context of the OECD to extend that globally, to have a global minimum tax of 15%. Some experts say it should be upwards of 25% as a global minimum to really put a floor under which companies can no longer avoid taxes globally. And then the last principle is around transparency. People say transparency is the best disinfectant. I don't know if it's the best disinfectant. Where I grew up, you really have to scrub some of the dirt, put your elbow grease into it. Sunlight itself is not going to do it, but it's pretty good. It's a good start. You know, countries across the world have now started mandating what they call public country-by-country reporting, where large businesses like the ones we've been discussing in the EU, for example, are now mandated to submit to the tax authorities where they pay corporate tax all over the world, how much, when, and some of the details around that, some key financial details. So many of the U.S. multinational companies that may say they don't want to do corporate tax transparency, it's a big burden, if they operate in the EU, they're already starting to release those types of corporate tax transparency measures. And then, as you all know maybe better than me, the Worldwide Combined Reporting Initiative that Minnesota embarked on, I think, is is really a leading light in terms of better understanding the taxes due by some of the most profitable companies in the world. And again, not just raising more revenue and having more information, but also leveling the playing field with lots of smaller businesses. So, you know, I want to thank you for inviting me today. You've all taken real leadership on this issue around corporate tax transparency. And people across the country and across the world are really watching. It's a great moment to have an increase in corporate tax transparency. And then lastly, I just want to end with a quote by FDR, where the Roosevelt Institute, I thought it would be appropriate to do so. He said back in 1938, just about a year before Hitler went down to Italy to meet Mussolini and began the fascist alliance in the context of that growing fascism in Europe. He said, which I think kind of echoes today, he said, among us today, a concentration of private power without equal in history is growing. The concentration is seriously impairing the economic effectiveness of private enterprise. Tax has a real value in working against a further concentration of economic power. And I think I'll leave you with that. Thank you so much for your attention. I look forward to a discussion.
Thank you so much, Mr. Luciani, for that presentation. So we're going to turn now to member discussion and Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, looking at your slides, you're tracking things from 1971 to 2019. Did you also do some of the same tracking and styles when you're creating some of your databases on tracking the actual same business? You know, I understand, you can create unique things when you look at just the top 10%. But, looking how tax policy actually affects the same business, not necessarily top businesses, and how that would potentially be affected.
Yeah. Mr. Luciani.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you for that question. In terms of the profit shares affected by tax, that particular graph, we didn't have the opportunity to look at specific companies over time. We wanted to really look at the aggregate picture. But when we looked at the markups data, which was another important piece there, we saw that as the companies did change, they went in and out of the top 10%, there was still a marked increase in markups of those firms that were coming in and out. Thank you for the question. I think at least I can say with authority that markups is both an aggregate and specific firm phenomenon over the course of the last 40 or 50 years.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of on a second note, looking at, one of the realities we do know is that tax policy for corporations, that tax incidence studies really recognize the fact that, while you talk about product markups and you talk about other things, that 90 to 95% of corporate taxes are paid by the consumer. How does your organization kind of jive with that if you're concerned about rising prices in the marketplace, but also understanding that taxes get burdened onto the people actually purchasing the products? How does that work with your...
Yeah, Mr. Luciani.
Thank you very much. There's been a lot of different studies on corporate tax incidents over the years. Both official studies and lots of different economists that are looking at this. I think it's fair to say that the lion's share, whether it's 60 or 70%, falls on capital owners. If you look at Gravel's studies over the course of the last 10 years and several others, the conventional scoring authorities, if you will, but also outside experts, whether it's JCT, CBO, Treasury, the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, they've all found that the corporate tax predominantly burdens shareholders and owners of capital income and not consumers.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would disagree with that. Just from what we've heard from our personal staff, when we've looked at potentially raising it, they've constituted the fact that you know, Minnesotans would pay 45% higher, and then also people from outside of the state would be potentially impacted as well to the same percentage. And just in general, looking at some other proposals that I've looked at, has your organization looked at all at how to potentially tax, you know, unrealized gains or using unrealized losses in tax policy and how that would potentially affect things in investment in the state?
Mr. Luciani.
Thank you. We haven't looked specifically at the impact on the state of Minnesota or the state-level impacts of taxing unrealized gains, but we have looked more generally at this various different federal initiatives around mark-to-market taxes or other forms of wealth taxation. And I think if you go back to the four R's of tax policy, raising revenue, creating more distributive channels, looking at, structuring an economy that works for all of us, I think there's some real redeeming qualities to creating a system which taxes capital gains, those unrealized gains, which, as you all know, are not taxed as an ordinary part of business yearly, are often passed on to heirs and never taxed at all through the step-up in basis. That's, in my opinion, a real loophole in our tax system, which we lose a lot of revenue from. And in fact, you know, if you think of it from an economic investment perspective, many people that don't want to be taxed on their capital gains are not investing in things that might be more economically efficient. They're holding on. It's called lock-in effect. They're holding on to particular investments from 20, 30, 40 years ago because they don't want to lose the privileged tax status of those particular securities. I think that's an economic problem as well.
Representative Sudzinski probably knows this, but I carried unrealized gains bill previously. Representative Smith now has it that does address that stepped-up basis in death, upon death. And the way that I think about it is, if you have a mortgage, you pay on your unrealized gains. You pay through property taxes. So the way that most of us have any wealth, most working class or middle class people build wealth is through the purchase of a home. Now, every year we get a valuation from our local assessor and then we get taxed based on that increase in valuation. And so what we have in this country, in our state, is a system where the most common way that regular people build wealth, you pay on that every year. You pay on it every year. But if you have millions of dollars invested in the stock market, if you are so lucky, you don't pay on that every year like we do on our houses. And so to me, I'm happy to talk more about unrealized gains in that stepped up basis, because I just think it's a real matter of basic fairness. Because, you know, the asset that we're all most likely to own, you do pay on the unrealized gains, not just upon death. So thanks for bringing that up. I won't. I did say Representative Smith's name, but we're not going to get a soliloquy from him about unrealized gains right now. I just took care of that. Sorry, guys. I know you were really wanting us to do that, to pass it over to Rep. Smith. But we'll go back. Representative Sudzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, just to finish up, you know, I think it's interesting, where we're at, and just, appreciate you coming before the committee, but just understanding, you know, the need to encourage investment within the state. We don't live in a vacuum. We have trusts, we have business trusts, we have a lot of ways to move assets across the state. We have former governors that utilize those tools in order to move their wealth across state lines to eliminate the burden for a tax here in Minnesota. And so I would just, you know, caution that, if we're looking for tax code, we're looking for openness, we're looking for gaining investment, that, you know, not being, you know, the top corporate tax in the state or in the country is probably not a place that we'd like to be. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. Before we move on, I missed a chance to put in a plug for the tax incidence study, which we have a new version of it that should just hit your inboxes. We'll see an overview of that. But just on that issue that Representative Sudzinski raised about the various progressivity and regressivity of the major tax types, we do have that updated information. Up next, Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is this. I believe this page 3 on the corporate profits as a percentage in the 1980s till the mid-90s, we see a decrease. How much of that do you attribute to the Reagan tax cuts? And if they or did they factor in, and how much of it would be because of the tax cuts? Also, as we see the increase going through the 2000s, isn't that a natural progression of globalization? Your thoughts.
Mr. Luciani.
Thanks very much. So the Reagan tax cuts did have a structural effect on both the corporate income tax in 1986 in particular, on the corporate income tax revenue as a percentage of GDP and as a percentage of the total federal tax rates. You know, that was one of, as you all know, one of the kind of landmark moments in the corporate tax history of the country. And I think it's important to reflect that the arguments that were made then are still partly being made now, which is that taxes are costs to business, they distort the economy, and in able to grow, we need to reduce those costs to allow companies to invest in hire workers, et cetera. That is a sort of narrative and set of arguments that really hasn't held up since 2000 and wasn't always the case. In fact, as I mentioned before, during the Great Moderation, the greatest generation post-World War II, whether it was FDR or Eisenhower or Truman, they all believed that the corporate tax was not a burden on a corporation, but it was an opportunity for a corporation to contribute to the well-being of the economy and the country as a whole, that corporate tax wasn't a distortion, but it was a way of directing economic progress in ways that we can all benefit from it, and that the tax system was, as a sort of excise tax, was really targeting the most wealthy corporations in a way that can drive down inequality and market concentration. Your second question on globalization, absolutely. I think the decrease in the tax take was a direct result of a number of different factors, trade policy as well as tax policy, which unleashed corporations to operate internationally almost unfettered. Also, it was a result of labor law and other issues. From the tax side, kind of unintentional impact of the check-the-box rules that the Treasury promulgated in the 90s, that really opened the floodgates to the type of offshore profit shifting, which was went hand-in-hand with globalization. And now as we're seeing some of the limits of globalization and the need to think about, some of the needs of our domestic economy, I think it's a really good opportunity also as an associated way to look at profit shifting as a detriment to our economy and really bring those profits back to where the economic activity takes place, both at the state and federal level.
Thank you. Representative Weiner?
Yes, thank you. So would you say that maybe a combination of tax cuts, Reagan-esque tax cuts, would bring businesses back and fix some of the supply chain issues that we saw, especially during COVID?
Mr. Luciani, would you say that? I'm curious.
No, I mean, I'm afraid not. I don't think companies operating that want to really invest in the economy and create the conditions for economic growth and for broad-based economic prosperity, those aren't the companies that are looking for ways to decrease their tax costs. Oftentimes, those are the companies that are happy to pay their taxes because it sees, at the same time, a better workforce over time and a more level playing field. So I actually think that the top 10% of firms, those that are essentially all their profits are being sent to shareholders, that are being extracted from the economic system and sent to shareholders, I think those companies don't deserve more tax breaks. I don't think more and more of a decrease in their tax contributions is going to incentivize them to invest, because they haven't been investing at all through the whole time that the corporate income tax burden has been lowering.
Representative Weiner?
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Up next, Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the conversation. You'd mentioned the tax incident study that was heard in the Senate today. And interestingly, it's my understanding that as corporate taxes are strongly contributing to our health of tax revenue collections here in Minnesota, it was noted that the corporate taxes are actually regressive because they are not really paid by a so-called corporation. They're paid by the consumers and the public. And so that's an important factor to note, as Minnesota has a 9.8% corporate tax rate. It's one of the highest in the country, or the highest in the country. And so it's curious that we're having a conversation here of can we grab more taxes from people, hardworking people and corporations and the operators and owners in Minnesota, while we just blew through a record $20 billion surplus and we had very little and no strong permanent tax reform for the people that are actually paying a lot of towards that surplus. Minnesota, as I've said before, certainly does not have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem, and we just simply have lacked the ability the last couple of years to control our spending. We've created more and more government programs. We've had to come back this year and anticipate looking at some of the programs that we established last year by the majority, and having to figure out how to execute those programs. And in some cases, I'm thinking the tax rates that were set in those weren't high enough to set up the programs they were intended to. So we have a spending problem, not a revenue problem. And I think if we actually looked at less regulation, less and lower tax rates, that would provide the incentive for the lower 50% of corporations to actually be more successful, for those mom and pop shops to be more successful, to operate more, to achieve the American dream. And it's mind-boggling that we are having a discussion on how to raise more revenue in this state when Minnesota taxpayers, Minnesota families are facing incredible amounts of inflation and price pressures in their own budgets. And we're sitting here looking at how we can get more money out of families. That's amazing that we're having this discussion.
That sounded like a statement, not a question to me. So up next, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. And I apologize to the chair and to the presenter. I had a couple of constituent meetings, so I apologize for missing part of the presentation. So many things I want to talk about. I think first, to the tax incident study, maybe, Madam Chair, staff could update us. The numbers I have most recently for the Minnesota 2021 tax incident study are that 77% of the corporate tax was actually borne by consumers, 11% by labor, and 12% by capital. So if someone has more updated numbers, that would be great. But clearly in our state, how you describe the share being borne is not what our own nonpartisan research has found.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Mr. Klayman, did you have something to?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, so Mr. Williams just handed me some figures from the latest incident study that was just released. Looks like, according to the Department of Revenue's incident study, 9% of the corporate franchise tax was allocated to capital, 5% to Minnesota labor, and then the remaining to consumers. And it looks like that breaks down roughly 40-some percent is exported, and then the rest is not exported. So that to non-residents versus residents.
Thank
consumers.
You, Mr. Klayman. Representative Robbins.
Thank you very much. And to the testifier, I know you mentioned the sort of new methodology about rents. And I have to be honest, it's been a while since I've taken a look at that, but I have read a lot about that in the past. And my understanding is that it was quite controversial and somewhat debunked. And so I just wondered if you could comment on the other side of that. I know that there was one study that showed that the theory had serious errors in measurement in these supernormal returns, and that they were misrepresented by 2 or 3 times. And so I just wondered, in your own research or in other, you know, controversies like this in economics that often gets in the weeds, but I think we've only heard one side of how that methodology is perceived. So I wondered if you could comment on the other side. And if not, that's okay. I just want to make a point for the record that it's not universally accepted.
Thank you. Mr. Luciani, did you want to dig in on any of those points?
Thank you, Chair. On the last point, I mean, the idea that we would treat normal returns differently than supernormal returns because there's a different economic impact to both of them, that's something that has been commonplace in many different tax policies over the past 50, 60 years, including those supported by Republicans, such as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which GILTI, for example, and FDII look at, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, differentiating income up to 10%, corporate income, and then over 10%. Simply because we have sort of, you know, in traditional economic theory, the idea that markets need to be competitive. That's the baseline. And if they're competitive, firms are going to compete against each other to get a normal rate of return. If markets are not competitive, there's going to be opportunities for companies to take advantage of that, or just through pure luck. Either way, they're distorting the markets in ways which allow them to produce super normal returns, meaning that those returns are taking away from other economic opportunities of other businesses, right? That's the theory. I think it's recognized in both Democratic and Republican tax legislation as recently as, you know, 2017. And I'm happy to send various different economic studies, Chair, over to the committee on the issue both of corporate tax incidence as well as, you know, this question of normal versus supernormal returns.
Sounds good. Representative Robbins is our economist, so I don't know what the difference is between a normal and supernormal return, but we'll pass those studies on to her, and maybe she can help us out. Representative Robbins,
yes. One more point. So just back to the whole tax incident study, I feel like the numbers you attributed to capital and how most of the burden falls on capital just are not borne out in our own state. But also, I just wanted to point out for the record that there are several other studies, particularly in Germany, the 2018 study, which now I can't read my own writing, but I think it was Faust, and then a Baker study in 2020. And they showed that by far the burden was primarily borne by consumer and labor. And so I think even in Germany with a much higher corporate tax rate, that continues to be kind of the norm, that the burden is higher for consumers and labor than for shareholders. So I think we need to keep that in mind. If you're trying to jam the corporations, you know, it's not really, that's not who's paying the price. And I know, Madam Chair, you really care about regressivity, so I just want that to be part of the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. In coming 2 weeks out from the February forecast here in Minnesota, I was really struck, and I'm sure most of us here were struck, about the rise in corporate tax returns, or corporate tax receipts. And, you know, we've enacted our 2023 budget. We've done some really good work, and we've continued to see corporate spending going up, corporate tax receipts going up. But to, I think, the point that you make in the last slide about the sunshine, we still don't know a lot about why that is. Right? And so I'm wondering if you could speak to, you mentioned Minnesota being a leader, but how we can continue to have more transparency around that so we can better understand that rise in corporate tax receipts and how we can then, as tax policymakers, continue to figure out how that plays into our state budgets moving forward.
Mr. Luciani.
Sure. Thanks very much for the question. So I would say, in terms of transparency steps, after, you know, 20 years trying to deal with this very question of understanding corporations' tax, and large corporations, I'm saying, not small businesses, large corporations' tax affairs, the world has come up with this solution, as I mentioned before, called public country-by-country reporting. Many companies actually voluntarily took it upon themselves, including Shell, Vodafone, several others, before it was mandatory, they took it upon themselves to be fully open and transparent about their corporate tax affairs, because they wanted to let the public, but also their investors, know that there wasn't anything to worry about. And many investors, and I know because I've talked with a lot of them, are increasingly growing concerned about potential tax risks of companies that they're invested in, and the fact that they don't have the information on how risky a particular tax position is means that, you know, in some cases, some investors are pulling out of companies that are not properly transparent around their taxes. And so the private sector is growing more and more concerned with this and believe they want to take the narrative, they want to, you know, use this as an opportunity to explain their own tax record rather than have it explained to them. That's happening. As I said before, the European Union is now mandating country-by-country reporting. The Financial Accounting Standards Board, as you may know, has now required companies to give a little bit more information in their tax payments overseas. And the next step, really, I think, is state after state after state in this country, in any way that makes sense to their particular location, create as many transparency rules as possible. If companies don't have anything to hide, and I suspect most of them don't, they shouldn't be concerned about this. It's not a burden, because most of the large corporations are already producing this for other jurisdictions. Why wouldn't they do it for Minnesota? And so I think the idea of making tax returns public is a good one. These are public corporations, the ones that we're looking at. They benefit from all of the protections associated, limited liability, you know, company executives essentially being immune to many of legal protection, system because of their role in the company. There are many different ways that corporations are protected by the public. The least they can do is be transparent about how they are or aren't paying their contributions and tax.
Thank you. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you for your presentation. It you know, helped to kind of explain the overall story of your presentation, kind of explain what I see a lot in my district. I have a district where we don't have a lot of big multinational corporations, but we have a lot of small businesses. And I hear from them a lot of frustration around, you know, this notion that, you know, large corporations are seeing increasing profit margins while paying relatively fewer taxes, and these smaller businesses are trying to get by on narrower margins while paying relatively more in taxes. And near the end of your presentation, you had a slide, kind of what can be done, and I'm curious, you know, narrowing down on Minnesota specifically and state-level tax policy, keeping in mind the fact that you know, capital and people are more mobile than ever. What are some things we can be doing here at the state level to try to correct that growing disparity while also making sure that we do remain a place that businesses want to operate?
Yeah.
Mr. Luciani.
Thanks very much. As I mentioned before, I think, you know, really creating opportunities for companies to be transparent on their taxes, the large corporations. The fact is that when you don't have a law in place to do that, you're kind of preventing some of the good companies that want the world to know about their corporate tax payments and their contributions, preventing them from doing so because they'd be sticking their neck out. So creating that kind of clear mandate on corporate tax transparency, I think, is really important. Is again not only for tax makers, for investors, for suppliers that want to make sure their companies, the companies they're supplying to are paying the taxes, but also for a lot of small firms that feel like the system's rigged. They can go and say, hey, maybe I'm purchasing from this particular company, and it looks like they just released their tax information. They're doing a pretty good job. They're paying this amount. That's contributing to society. I feel good working with them. And they would be able to compare how much they're paying in corporate tax to the biggest companies. And I think that would, depending on what the information said, that would really start a real conversation of who pays the tax burden in the economy and by business. And I think that's a valuable conversation to have. And over time could lead to maybe a more even playing field between the small and the largest companies, which would really benefit everyone, I think.
Thank you, Chair.
Great, thank you. Are there any further member questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. I'm really thankful for the conversation today. I think we had a good kind of lively engagement with the material in front of us. I do just want to say I didn't invite Mr. Luciani here to jam any corporations or anything. I did, although I do kind of like that term, maybe I'll use it. But I just think, as Chair Olson said, it was evident in our forecast that these trends in terms of profits and corporate receipts are influencing our bottom line, influencing our budget. And, I really don't see this. This is, there's not a lot of good things to say about some of the political trends more broadly in our country lately. Like, it feels like we're more and more divided in a lot of different ways. But to me, one of the bright spots is that I don't think this is a partisan issue anymore. I don't think the issue of corporate control is a partisan issue anymore. I think that if you went to your constituents and to my constituents, all of the people who we represent would say, it's not right. It's not right that the biggest corporations in the world are able to hire these like fancy lawyers and accountants, figure out how to dodge taxes, while our local mom and pop businesses, they don't have that capacity. Most of the businesses in our districts that we think of, like when we think of our business community and that we interact with, and we interact with the owners of businesses and their employees, they can't send their intellectual property to Bermuda. They probably don't have any intellectual property to send to Bermuda. And so, this is just of increasing concern to all of us and to all of our constituents. The reality that the wealthiest among us, the biggest corporations, are really able to, engage in legal tax avoidance strategies that mean that when that bill comes due, because as we discuss in this and other committees, we have obligations as, stewards of the public good to make sure that there are roads and schools and, the things that everybody needs in their communities to have a good life. And when those bills come due and we have the people who are benefiting the most in the current economy managing to duck their obligations to contribute to that public good, then the bills still have to be paid and the burdens go on to us. They go on to regular people. They go on to, small business owners and those Main Street businesses that we're talking about. And so, again, it's like I think this is important information for us to keep in mind as we're moving forward and thinking about how it is that we have build and uphold a tax code that treats people fairly and that doesn't give undue benefits to, a lot of the entities that are engaging in some of these strategies and that are benefiting from you know, greater kind of concentration of power in certain hands in our economy and less for the rest of us. So did Jeff Brand want to say something? Oh, no, you're going to let me. Okay. All right. Cool. Great. Well, okay. So, again, I just want to express my gratitude to Mr. Luciani. Thank you so much for coming and for sharing this information with us. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 6th, same time, same place. We're going to hear, as I said, from Dr. Kalambakidis, our state economist, and we'll be hearing a couple of bills. And with that, we are adjourned.